Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. One of the best things that happened to comedy in recent years was Dimitri Martin walking away from a free ride at NYU Law School with 1 year to go for a career in stand-up instead. During his varied career, Martin has written for Conan O'Brien, appeared as a correspondent on The Daily Show, acted in films like Taking Woodstock, Contagion, and In a World, written 2 books, and recorded 5 stand-up special CDs. Often compared to Mitch Hedberg and Stephen Wright, Martin's comedy is at once deeply layered and incisive, and uproariously basic. Martin's latest tour, The Persistence of Jokes, comes to The Egg in Albany on January 29th.
I think vests are all about protection. Like, the life vest protects you from drowning. And the bulletproof vest protects you from getting shot. And the sweater vest protects you from pretty girls. Leave me alone. Can't you see I'm cold just right here? There's a narrow cold front sweeping through Chicago. Dress appropriately. Got these giant fat arms and a skinny torso. What should I wear? I heard this lady say, "I love kids." That's nice. It's kind of weird, though. It's like saying, "I like people for a little while."
Dimitri Martin, it's my pleasure to welcome you back to The Roundtable. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Ian. How you doing?
Great. Your new tour is The Persistence of Jokes, and I'm wondering how long it took you to work up this much new material.
Oh, let's see. It's sometimes hard for me to gauge because, you know, they're mostly short jokes, and it's kind of like one in, one out. You know, I get a new one to work that I like, and then maybe I can remove a joke I've been doing for a while. But I'd say generally maybe about a year, to have a new full set.
Because of the style of your show, which can be cerebral and you've got, you know, music and you've got drawings that are a part of it, is it more difficult for you to test material out? Because a lot of comics talk about, you know, trying to go to, you know, a club on a random Monday night to work things through.
Yeah, for me, there's an interesting process because when I play the guitar with some jokes or if I try a bit involving drawings or something else, the building blocks are still, for me, jokes. It's still kind of the same thing. So often what I end up doing is I do a lot of the small rooms in New York or L.A. and try out new material. And then when I feel like, hey, these jokes are working, sometimes I'll look at them and say, you know, this joke might work even better with an accompanying drawing. Maybe I'll get an extra punchline off of it or something. So I still get to test them as just spoken jokes. Most of the stuff I do up there would work without adding music or something. But then I find some of the bits work even better if I add that little extra layer. But even when I first started, it was mostly just standing there telling one-liners. I do have some bits that are hard to try, and I've done them in TV specials where pretty much the first time I did the bit was in front of that audience at that taping, which isn't the smartest way to do stuff. But yeah, I can't test some of those things on the road, so I just have to roll the dice and try it that night, and hopefully it works.
When you are working things out, how do you know? As you just said, you know, when the jokes start to work, then you might take them to the next level with music or a drawing. But when do you know that the jokes are working?
I always say that you can't really know with any of these jokes or any comedy bits 100%. It seems more like probabilities. And the more trials you have, the more test cases, we'll call them, then the better a sense you have. But I don't know if I have anything that works 100%, but I have some that have worked. If I did the joke 40 times or 26 times or 70 times, whatever, then I'd say, okay, well, out of those 70 times, it worked 62 times. I don't know what happened those other 8 times. I followed somebody dirty. There was a heckler or somebody coughed when I said one of the words in the setup. That town doesn't like that topic. Somebody died in a fire 2 years ago in that building. I didn't know about it. You know, something like that. These variables you don't know about. But generally, yeah, that's, for me, it's more kind of probabilities. So the more times I can perform leading up to a recording of some kind. You know, often I think of recording my next album or shooting the next TV special so that I have at least these very definite markers where I say, oh, I recorded that hour of material and now I'm going to... It's like a lot of comedians. What I'm saying isn't, you know, very different from anyone else. But I guess I'm mentioning that just because those are the points in time where I stop and say, okay, so what's working? Mm-hmm. What do I want to record here? What do I want to take a chance and record? Because once it's recorded, I can't take it back. And of course, I want to pick the ones that do the best. Having said that, there are jokes that I just like to tell that don't get the biggest laugh, but I like that it's part of my set, you know? And maybe that's where more of the cerebral side of it comes in sometimes. I don't think there's anything too complicated in what I'm doing, but some of the stuff's maybe more subtle and doesn't hit as hard. But I like that the ideas are part of my show.
I mean, in your line of work, you're putting yourself out there. And let's say you tell a joke and 62 out of 70 times it does work. Did the other 8 stay with you and nag you? Or do you, you know, over the years you've been doing this, have you learned to, you have to get over it?
Yeah, I think in volume, a lot of things change, you know, that I remember when I first started, when I had only done one show and then I'd only done 5 and then I'd done 20, it was my whole career was 20 performances. So if that were what I was looking at to judge myself or my material or my comedy, that puts a lot of weight on those 20 shows. 17 years later, the shows pile up. And for me personally, the highs aren't as high and the lows aren't as low, which is good and bad. You know, it's not such a tragedy when I bomb. It might be for the audience, but I don't think so. I think probably I'm the one who cares the most. But it's also not such a big victory when jokes go well. Having said that, I still do get a high off of getting a new joke to work, especially if I try a joke for the first time or it's only the second or third time I've told it. There's something really still very exciting about that to me, to say, hey, all right, I still got it. You know, that's, I'm not crazy. That's funny to other people too. But a lot of my time is just spent, you know, quietly just thinking about these things. And by the time I get to the audience, a lot of the process is over. I mean, hopefully I deliver it well and they like the idea. Mm-hmm. But it's, in terms of writing jokes, it's, for me, a much more solitary thing. On the other hand, over the years, I have gotten better at writing jokes on stage or improvising. So I guess that's the difference between, you know, presenting comedy and making comedy there. When it goes well, I feel like I'm making some comedy with the audience. But if I'm tired or they're not giving me a lot, then maybe I'm just presenting. Say, okay, This is what I prepared. Here we go.
One thing for people who have seen your show before that I love about what you do is you'll often at the end take requests for old jokes or old bits, and you know, people will shout out favorite one-liners and you'll sometimes do them. I was wondering how you archive that material for yourself. I was thinking about the Joan Rivers documentary where she has literally filing cabinets full of jokes, you know, and she might rifle through before a weekend set or something. Do you have anything akin to that?
I really like that documentary, and that's one of the moments that really stood out for me too, was seeing those files, that card catalog. And I didn't know Joan Rivers. I never met her. I think she was a great joke writer. When she passed away, I remember thinking, I wonder if her daughter or her family, if they would ever publish a book, like an art book. To me, that's like art, you know, and just put those cards, like 9 per page or something. It would be such an interesting book to see the artist in her, how she worked. What I have are, I have binders. I have little loose leaf binders. They're not little, like, you know, kind of standard size. And I have a lot of jokes written in, you know, Word documents. I write a lot of them by hand in notebooks. But I have a little system, yeah, that's not as elaborate as what I saw in the Joan Rivers documentary. But I've gotten organized in the last few years, so I have... Often I make tables, you know, it's pretty nerdy, but it'll be like in Word, and, you know, they just have the columns and the rows, and it'll say, you know, joke, what do I have? It's usually like joke, done, sometimes it says done on, like, you know, what, did I do this on a TV show? Did I do this on a late night spot? Did I do this on an album? And then it'll say, and there's a grading system, especially when I'm trying to develop a set, so on the far right it'll say, maybe level or something. I can't remember. I don't know if there's a title for that column. But, you know, it'll say A, B, C. So as I'm trying the jokes, I can put them in this little table, and I have a record. So I can look back and say, in 2009, those are the jokes I was trying, and that I thought that one was an A and that one was a C. And I can go back, if I'm touring now, and say, oh, I forgot about that joke. Maybe I can get that one. Maybe I can improve the grade on that one.
Huh.
I'll try it on this tour. And then I'm writing jokes along the way, too. So, yeah, there's a backlog and some sort of a dialogue between the present and the past here as I'm trying to work out some of these ideas.
I want to also ask you about this movie, Dean, which I guess is now in post-production. It's your first,
yeah.
It's your directorial debut. You also wrote it and star in the movie.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, it's your first movie.
Yeah, it's my first movie. It was, parts of it were exciting and thrilling. A lot of it was exhausting, and I think some of it is frustrating. I was thrilled to get Kevin Kline to be in the film. I'm a fan of his. I didn't know him, but he liked the script enough that he agreed to meet with me. And then after the meeting, we talked, and I made some notes and worked on the script some more, and then he said, yeah, he'd do it. So that was really cool, and it really lived up to my expectations. He was a real professional and very creative, and getting to do scenes with a guy like that was, for me, very exciting. What was frustrating was not having enough time, not having enough money. I don't think it's a unique problem. It sounds like even in big-budget movies that happens, but it was pretty breakneck pace. It was really hard. And I think I gained new respect for producers who do it well, because we didn't have locations a lot of days, you know, things that nobody cares to hear me complain about. But it sometimes feels like a miracle when a movie is good, especially these small indies, because there's so much you're up against. And you run out of light, and you're just trying to shoot so much each day. You don't get a lot of takes, you know, and that affects performance. You don't have a lot of time to set up the lights so that it looks a certain way. So you can see just all these variables come into play that I never have to worry about in stand-up. On the other hand, there's an intimacy that I feel like I can achieve with film that isn't the same on stage. I can't do it in my stand-up that way. And it's fun to get to act and to play a character and to have the real estate of a movie screen or TV screen to play on, to put different, you know, my character's an illustrator, so I thought it'd be fun to have characters an illustrator so I can put some drawings in the movie and show how he thinks and what's going on in this guy's life that way. That's a little different than what I would do on stage. Of course, I put drawings on stage, and I've done a book of drawings, so I like drawing, and I think there's something great about even simple drawings and communicating ideas and feelings and everything, but to put it in a narrative story on screen, to me, was a cool opportunity. So that's where I'm at now in post and trying to put the thing together.
When will it come out?
Yeah, I asked myself the same question because I still have to make it good enough to submit it to festivals. I wanted to submit to Sundance this year. I've been to that festival once before as an actor, and it was really fun. I thought, oh, I'd love to go. But it's just not ready, you know. It's not good enough yet. We have a first assembly, and now we're doing the second cut here. But if I'm lucky, I'll have it in shape by the winter, and then I'll shop it to festivals in 2015. And I guess if I'm really lucky, it would come out late 2015 or early 2016.
When you get back to the editing bay with 3 weeks worth of film, and all of that part of the process is over, is that in itself scary or frustrating to know that, okay, what we have here is what we have to work with?
Yeah. I think that's where I really feel the limitations of budget and time, and I can look at what we shot and say, I know the answer. Why didn't I get that coverage? Why don't I have a better master? And I said, oh, I remember, because that was the only place we could put the lights because the person at the location wouldn't allow us to do this, you know. So I had to shoot it on a weird angle. So yeah, it's frustrating. It's like retroactively frustrating because it's in the past and I can't change it, and I know why I couldn't do what I wanted in the first place. But on the other hand, which I keep saying today for some reason, I'm really into hands. I think about what I've heard, which is you write a movie three times. You write it on page, you write it while you're shooting, and you write it while you're editing. So when I think of it in those terms as, okay, I have a pile of raw material here, what's the best story I can tell with it? Then it becomes more of a challenge and more of a puzzle, and it's more fun. rather than trying to make it exactly what I thought it was going to be. Because I've heard time and again from different filmmakers and interviews and things I've read that it's never going to go the way you thought. I got to meet Alexander Payne years ago, and I think he's a great filmmaker.
He's great.
And he's pretty accessible. He's a nice person. And he gave me some advice. He goes, when I set out to make a film, I feel like I'm going to make a beautiful omelet. And I always end up with scrambled eggs. And it was such a nice, simple way to put it. And now that guy makes great eggs, whether they're scrambled eggs or whatever they are. He makes great films. But to hear a guy like that say that, you know, of course, it gives you some perspective. You say, well, I think he's one of the great filmmakers we have. And he has that frustration. I'm just starting, and I made a pretty small movie, but I could certainly feel it. I was like, man, I hope this is edible.
In this area, you shot Taking Woodstock right down the road here from us in Albany. So a lot of people around here were kind of rooting for your movie career, I think. Were you able to ask Ang Lee, who directed that film, for his advice on how to be a director or anything like that?
I was just coincidentally able to do that because I was in the airport and I heard someone call my name. This is after I shot my movie, but it was still cool. I heard Dimitri and I looked up and there was Ang. He just saw me putting my laptop back in my bag after going through security. He happened to be walking through that part of the airport. So we ended up walking together and talking. I hadn't talked to him in a while. And I told him about my film and everything. And yeah, he gave me some good advice. And he was nice. He said, you know, he said to me, you're an actor. He said, you can act. You know, don't forget that. Like, you should pursue that, which was nice. So we're talking about directing and stuff too. But he said, what you have to offer is a sincerity and a vulnerability. And he was saying certain things. And now years later, it was nice to hear him say that. So I felt encouraged, and I was like, yeah, that's right. That's part of why I want to make movies, even if I'm not the star, even if I can play a part in a movie that I wrote, because there's an opportunity there.
Dimitri Martin will bring the Persistence of Jokes tour to The Egg in Albany Thursday, January 29th at 8 o'clock, and you can catch him on House of Lies. His feature film debut as a director, Dean, will be coming out sometime this year. And Dimitri Martin, it's just been a pleasure to have you back on the roundtable. Good luck with everything.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for making the time. Appreciate it.
I want to make a jigsaw puzzle that's 40,000 pieces. And when you finish it, it says, go outside. I went into this clothing store, and the lady working there, she got mad at me. She said, what size are you? I said, actual. This ain't a trick, baby. She was amazing. I never met a woman like this before. She showed me to the dressing room and she said, if you need anything, I'm Jill. I thought, oh my God, I never met a woman before with a conditional identity. What if I don't need anything? Who are you? If you don't need anything, I'm Kevin.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.